I'm your host, Michael Callahan. This is Where We Go Next. And have you ever found yourself biding time in an airport at a Hudson News, seen a politician's biography prominently displayed, and thought to yourself, who reads these things? These vanity projects, these self-congratulatory, often banal attempts to reframe one's own flawed legacy. But what if within the pages of these autobiographies, hiding in plain sight, were novel observations into the character and motivations of their authors? Our guest today has made a career of digging deep within these texts. Not only books by politicians, government officials, and candidates, but centuries-old essays and decades-old commission reports, along with Supreme Court decisions and congressional investigations, and mining revelatory insights that most other people miss. Carlos Lozada is an opinion columnist at the New York Times and co-host of the Matter of Opinion podcast. He has won the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism, and he's the author of What Were We Thinking? A Brief Intellectual History of the Trump Era. His new book, The Washington Book, How to Read Politics and Politicians, is out now. Carlos, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
In your introduction to the Washington book, adapted from a speech you gave at your alma mater, Notre Dame, you write, quote, "The relentless negativity about political books misses the point of reading them," end quote. So what are we missing?
I've been reading Washington books for 25 years, for my entire career as a journalist. And the thing that people tell me more than anything when they find out that this is what I do, they say, "Thank you for reading those books so that we don't have to read them." Honestly, that is an extremely common response.
It's like a visceral response.
And the implication of that is that these books are bad, right? They're self-serving, they're ghostwritten, they're propaganda. The Washington Post, my former employer, even ran an opinion piece a little bit ago. I think the headline was, "Does anyone actually read presidential campaign biographies?" It was a rhetorical question because the obvious answer was no one should. They shouldn't even be published. These books are wretched. I will say, yes, there are some wretched political books. I've read a lot of them, but I'm a big believer in the Washington book. I think that there's so much to learn through these books. And really, that critique is a bit hypocritical because those same very serious readers who would never lower themselves to read, say, the memoir by Donald Trump's third press secretary, which I have read, they still want to know what's in the books, right? They don't ask me if it's good. They want to know, like, what scores are settled, who talks trash about who else. And they want a brutal takedown of the books by politicians they don't like and rapturous praise about books by politicians they do like. But the real reason to read them is that no matter how carefully politicians sanitize their experiences and their records in these books and present themselves in the most favorable and electable light possible, they end up revealing themselves. They admit something or show us something that helps us see them in a new light. They expose their fears, their insecurities, their ambitions. And so you end up learning a lot, I think, not just about the character of these politicians, but also about the character of the country. After all, when they present themselves in whatever way they present themselves, they do that because they think that's what we want. That's what we like. So they're also telling us what they think of us.
Something you just said there, paraphrasing, quote, "They don't ask me if it's good. They want to know what scores are settled, and they want a brutal takedown of the books by politicians they don't like, and rapturous praise for the politicians they do like," end quote. In other words, they want what you refer to in the book as the Washington read. And it is, like much of how we frame and talk about politics today, inherently reductive. We want to take the whole of a thing and summarize it in just a few sentences. Good guys versus bad guys, correct opinions versus incorrect opinions. Which way is the wind blowing so I know where exactly to fix my sails? Is the Washington read the chicken or the egg? Is it a symptom of our broken politics, the cause of it, or both?
So I first encountered the notion of the Washington read in an essay by uber Washington pundit Chris Matthews, who years ago said that even Washingtonians don't read these books. They give it the Washington read, which means at best they skim it, or they read the first chapter and pretend they've read the whole book. Or if you're a Washington power broker, you go to the index, You look for your own name. You go to those pages to see how you're treated. And depending on the answer to that, you decide that you like the book or not. As far as which comes first, I'm not sure what the answer is to that, because the Washington books are both a reflection of our politicians, but also a reflection of our politics. They hope to shape our politics, but they also reflect it. And it's no surprise that these books come in waves. Even in recent years, you had during the Trump presidency, it's been a lot of the death of democracy books. There were just like a multitude, how democracies die, surviving autocracy. Then suddenly you had all these civil war books. Things got really drastic and dire. And all these books about whether we're going to enter a new civil war, books about polarization. They all kind of come together. So they end up reflecting the politics that already exists, even as they're trying to shape it.
Your reading of these texts is the exact opposite of the Washington read. Rather than condense hundreds of pages into a sloganeering judgment, your work is inherently expansive. A single sentence within a larger work may prove itself illuminatory. Can you trace back to a moment, perhaps earlier in your career, when you realized how much there was to uncover in books and documents that most of your peers were only taking cursory glances at?
I think I've always enjoyed digging deep into documents and books. When the New York Times reviewed my first book, in which I also did the same thing, did a lot of deep reading on the books of the Trump era, they said that my reading all those books was an act of transcendent masochism. And, you know, and that wasn't a positive review of my own book, but that the exercise was masochistic. And I've never really found it that way, because for me, it's worth going through the trouble of slogging through a massive commission report or memoir to find just like one or two key moments. I'll give you one example that was early in my time as a book critic for The Washington Post. You think there were a lot of Trump books that have come out during the last several years, but really Obama was also just like an incredible font of books and manifestos and attacks against him and books praising him, not to mention his own works. So I read a lot of the Obama volumes as they came out, including his own books, but also books about him. One that stays with me is by the young guy who served as his quote unquote body man, right? The sort of personal aide who kind of makes sure that he gets to where he needs to go on time.
Reggie
Love. Exactly. Exactly. For West Wing fans, the Charlie character. Reggie Love wrote a memoir called Power Forward, My Presidential Education. And he tells the story of one time during the first presidential campaign, Reggie forgot to bring Obama's briefcase on the plane, which is a huge no-no. That's your one job, to make sure that he has his stuff. He was worried he was going to get fired. Obama was annoyed, but he ended up forgiving him. And Reggie Love mentions in passing something that Obama told him about one of the reasons he was annoyed about the missing bag. Obama wanted to be seen carrying something off the plane. It projected vigor. And he said to Reggie Love, JFK carried his own bags. And just that line alone tells me so much about how carefully Barack Obama thought about and shaped his public image. So much so that he would draw on our most mythologized, perhaps past president, to think about how he wanted to present himself in public. Reggie Love's memoir was fine, but really that one line, that one moment is what I remember the most. And more than any big reveals, more than any sort of like news-making material, it's often little moments like that in a book that otherwise you might not think provides enormously lasting material that really does prove lasting, that tells you something about people in power. So I always think of that moment, JFK carried his own bags, as like a little gem that I found inside Reggie Love's book.
Three of the essays out of the collection of 50 stood out to me as they relate to something you just said, the sort of mythological nature of how we construct our narratives and how we imbibe narratives that others construct for us. And it was The Speechwriter, The Project of the 1619 Project, and The Self-Referential Presidency of Barack Obama. Essays about the power of myth-making and the sort of meta nature of how narratives are constructed, how much truth they do or don't contain, and how important the truth actually is. How important would you say, just based on your deep knowledge of these texts, whether they're legal or otherwise, how important is the actual truth about a thing? Whether or not it actually happened according to the witnesses who were there, How important is the truth in the construction of a narrative?
Narrative is one of those complicated words, right? Because narrative immediately connotes that you're being spun in some way. You're being told a story to a certain end. If truth is the salad, narrative is the salad dressing, right? Washington journalists love to talk about the narrative. Like it's this thing that's independent of them. You know, like we construct narratives in our journalism and our stories because narratives make it easier to digest reality. When I read these books, including in the three essays that you just mentioned, it's not that I find a lot of gotcha moments where someone is flat out lying. That's less interesting to me than moments of interpretation, moments when someone is taking a truth, but making it mean the thing that that person wants it to mean. In the book, The Speechwriter that you mentioned, that's a book by this writer named Barton Swaim, who served as the speechwriter for Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina, who, if he's famous for one thing, it's for disappearing for a few days while he was governor, telling folks that he was hiking the Appalachian Trail when he was, in fact, hooking up with his girlfriend in Argentina, his girlfriend who was not his wife. Swaim says something really interesting in that book because it's all about his experience being a speechwriter. He reaches this interesting conclusion about political rhetoric. He says, one hears very few proper lies in politics. Using vague, slippery, or just meaningless language is not the same as lying. It's not intended to deceive so much as to preserve options, buy time, distance oneself from others, or just sound like you're saying something instead of nothing. And his point is that politicians are asked every day to weigh in on things on which they have no knowledge, sometimes no interest, or no ability to actually reveal what they know. But they have to respond, right? So that's where to sound like you're saying something instead of nothing comes in. That's such a great distillation of the art of politics. And that's how I think of my job a little bit, or the way I do journalism, that if the art of politics is to drain meaning from language, to produce more and more words that say less and less, I feel like my purpose is try to scoop up that meaning and stick it back in. That's what I'm attempting to do. But really, that first book you mentioned, which is called The Speechwriter, is really just a wonderful book about how politicians communicate.
I think I take for granted the fact that I'm not in politics. I work in the entertainment industry here in Los Angeles, and I come from a filmmaking and storytelling background. And so I think that I approach the word narrative from a different perspective. Hearing you talk about it, all of a sudden, you know, it clicks for me. Of course, narrative in the world of politics usually means spin. Totally understand. What I'm thinking of when I think of narrative is journalist and guest of the show, Amanda Ripley, has a book called High Conflict, in which she talks about something she calls the understory, or what the story beneath a political conflict is really about, which is often and usually unknown to the actual participants themselves. So an example that a directing teacher of mine a decade ago gave is you have a couple, let's say they're in a kitchen, and they're fighting over who does the dishes. And they think the argument is about the dishes. But in fact, the actual argument that maybe they are or are not aware of is you don't tell me you love me anymore, or you stay at work really late. And so you're distant. And so me saying you never do the dishes, even if that is actually in the moment what I think I'm angry about, I might not actually be aware that that is simply a symptom of the fact that I don't see my husband anymore. And so for me, when I think about narratives, and I totally understand the context in which you're applying that word, I'm just fascinated from a political and non-political perspective by how we construct the narratives about our own lives, how we're often unaware of when and how we're constructing those narratives, and how the why or the how of a thing is often as important as what actually happened, right? Like the crime scene might show like a knife and a body, but the actual why of why it happened, that's the narrative. He did me wrong. She betrayed me. And so I just find the interplay of those two things really interesting. And I love how your essays really dig into that.
It's interesting. When you were mentioning the dishes scenario and the Amanda Ripley book, I immediately thought of The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis.
Yes.
Because the premise of the book is that it's two devils corresponding with each other on the progress they're making and tempting humans to come to their side.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of it is about get your human, because they're assigned humans, get your human to think about his or her problem in this particular way, when in fact, it's about something else entirely. Get them to go to church and just be annoyed at the sort of nasal voice of the priest so that he can just fixate on that rather than on what the Bible reading is about. So I immediately thought of Wormwood and Screwtape.
Yes.
The two devils in that book. But I think you're right. And here's maybe where sort of the Hollywood and Washington versions of narrative come together, is that narratives are cumulative and they build on each other over time. And so you think you're having a story arc that is about one particular thing, but actually there's always far more depth to it. I think that's probably the same in LA or in DC.
Yes. You know, at a recent event for your book, you were being interviewed by journalist and Atlantic staff writer Mark Leibovich, and he said, quote, "As journalists, we have our noses pressed against the glass. We can see inside, but we're not quite inside. You, speaking of you, Carlos, have an even greater remove, in that you are not chasing Marjorie Taylor Greene around the hill. You are actually reading books about that." And then he asks you, "Do you ever yearn for a closer look?" End quote. And I found that question really interesting because I'm not sure if Mark meant it like this, but it feels like a judgment to me, and if I may be so bold, an inaccurate one, because I would argue just from reading your works, Carlos, that your method does give you a closer look, right? Like to harken back to the sloppy crime scene analogy, your look at these public figures is more intimate than what might actually be possible were you actually physically with them day to day. If you're trying to catch a mosquito in the air and look at all of its details, it's much easier to do when it's encased in amber and you can look at it from all angles all the time. And this was something I never even really considered. Before reading your essays, I would have assumed that it is actually the advantage to be as close to the person you're covering as possible. But now I realize, in the same way that we are not always aware of the problems within our own relationships, but our closest friends can tell us that we should probably get a divorce, similarly, you almost need a remove to attain the kind of intimacy you need to see those small details.
First of all, thank you. I love the idea that it gives me a better vantage point than all the reporters out hustling around town. I think it's a different vantage point. I think they're both useful. And a lot of the books that I read and I write about in these essays in the Washington book are about books by journalists who have done all that important legwork. And so I benefit enormously from it. I think that it's just a different vantage point. I don't know that it's necessarily better. I find that it works for me. In part because I think of these documents, these books, as my own primary sources. Rather than having a high place source in the White House, I read all the White House memoirs out of a certain administration. That tells me plenty about what they think. And also because everyone's the hero of their own story. No one's a marginal character in their own life. I guess it'd be rather sad if they were. In these books, you have to know that going in, that this mid-level aide is going to present herself as if she were vital to the whole enterprise. And that's not always true, but it's just a useful perspective. I find it compelling. The TV critic for the New York Times, James Poniewozik, wrote a really interesting book called Audience of One, where he attempted to make sense of the Trump era in American politics through television, both through Trump's use of television as a politician and as the host of The Apprentice before, but also just in what television gave us in the decades leading up to Trump and Trumpism, like the rise of the anti-hero in Breaking Bad and The Sopranos. He feels that gave permission for a politician like Trump to arise. And TV is another great way to interpret the era. It's no worse or no better than using books and documents. It's just the way that I like to look at it.
While reading through your essays, I couldn't help but hearken back to repeatedly a book I read, I think some 20 years ago now, The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien.
Oh, Vietnam, of course.
I don't have a larger question here, but I felt like there were thematic similarities there about how the larger truth of a thing and how it feels to the person who experienced it is oftentimes almost more important than the actual details themselves. And it feels like when you're analyzing these texts, especially if they're autobiographies or memoirs, etc., the person is trying to tell you, this is how something felt to me. And then within the context or within the tiny details of them trying to say, and this was the meaning of my presidency, you find a tiny little detail within that larger narrative they're trying to construct. And then that's the detail that actually is the thing behind the thing, the understory of the thing.
I'm honored by any parallel to The Things They Carried. But you're right. It's often a little thing that someone says or does in the course of the memoir. It's rarely like their big definitive statement about themselves. It's usually something more banal that you wouldn't think is a big reveal. I'll give you one example in the memoir by Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris wrote a memoir a few years ago. It came out, I believe it was 2019, called The Truths We Hold. And it's funny because I was waiting to see who Biden was going to pick as his running mate. And it seemed pretty clear he was either going to go with Susan Rice, who used to be the ambassador to the United Nations under Obama, or Senator Kamala Harris. And I had both books sitting on my desk. As soon as we had a name, I was going to just crash on reading that person's book and write about it. And for very ridiculous reasons, I was really hoping for Kamala Harris to get it because her book's a lot shorter. And it would be a lot easier to get through her book quickly. But here's one thing about that book. Harris keeps bringing up this notion of false choices. For instance, she said, it's a false choice that I have to support the police or that I have to be for police accountability. I'm for both. It's a false choice that I have to be either for the rights of undocumented immigrants or the rights of native U.S. citizens. I'm for both. And it's a phrase she's used even as vice president. It sounds very sage and wise to dismiss something as a false choice. And she may be right. She may be right about all these things being false choices, but politics is entirely about making difficult choices between competing priorities. And I think her default to this phrase so often, to me, suggested that she doesn't want to make some of these difficult choices, and she straddles two sides of difficult issues. And that may be one reason that she seems to have had a hard time carving out a very distinctive role as vice president. She doesn't like these difficult decisions, so she says they're not real. And that's not her big statement of beliefs or of values in this book. This is just something that I just picked up on because I saw it a few times. And then once I noticed it, I couldn't think about anything else.
Right. I remember seeing that insight in the book, and it crystallized so much for me because I haven't kept a close eye on Kamala Harris. But I've seen her talk, and she seems eloquent enough. She's personable and likable to my eyes. But, you know, I see these criticisms from Republicans, and I think I'm dismissive of them because I'm like, well, they would critique a tree stump if it had a Democratic pin on it. But when I see critiques coming from her side of the aisle about how she's not a good VP or she's not fit for the role, I always was kind of left wanting for explanation because I was like, well, obviously I can't see behind the curtain. I can't see what she's doing. But just from her public facing life, I guess I don't understand these critiques because she seems in her speeches kind of just like every other VP I've witnessed in my adult life. But your insight into how she frames it as these are false choices, we don't have to pick between the two, as a way to illuminate the fact that she seems unable to make the hard choices, because every choice in politics is always going to be a hard choice because you're always going to let someone down. And she seems reluctant to make those choices, all of a sudden made those things click for me. Ah, perhaps this is the critique, is that if something were to happen to Biden or if she were to run for president later on, it seems like she is unwilling to step up and make choices that might upset people. But in her mind, whether she believes it or not, she's saying, well, no, it's actually not me. These are false choices and we can have everything, when in fact, that has never been true.
Yeah, I think it's a critique. I don't know that it's the critique. I think some of the critiques about Kamala Harris are more knee-jerk and they become more significant given the concerns about Biden's age, because the notion of her ascending to the presidency becomes more realistic. One thing I'll say is that it's a really hard job to do well, vice president. You end up getting a lot of tasks that the president maybe doesn't want to deal with. It's like, hey, Kamala, you take care of the border for us, you know?
Jump on this grenade.
Yeah, I think it's especially hard to be a vice president for a president who used to be vice president. Because they know what it's like to feel like the second banana. Now that they finally ascended to the top job, they don't necessarily want to give a lot of choice jobs or assignments away. It's interesting. Think about the presidents who were formerly vice presidents, who they ended up picking as their VPs. For instance, George H.W. Bush, right? George H.W. Bush was vice president to Ronald Reagan. He picked Dan Quayle, at least one that, fairly or not, in the judgment of history, has kind of seemed like a weak vice president. That doesn't seem to me to be perhaps entirely by accident. I think that it's especially hard to do the job working for a person who used to do the same job.
Do you think that the through line behind why former vice presidents tend to choose weaker vice presidents when they become president themselves is motivated at all by a feeling of inadequacy at having once been the VP. And so they try to build themselves up by picking someone inherently weak to make themselves appear strong? Or is that too armchair psychologist of me?
No, I mean, I'm sure that people who have had the job pick their own VPs differently from those who haven't had that same experience. I'm not sure if it's precisely because it's like they're exacting revenge on their own past experience. One thing that I think is interesting, Obama, who of course was president and picked Joe Biden as his vice president, Obama would often refer to Joe Biden as my vice president. And Biden seems, someone would need to fact check me on this to make sure, I'm just thinking about it now. And I may have read this. I just read Franklin Foer's book about the Biden presidency, and this may be in there. Biden says the vice president, not my vice president, which I really respect. I like that a lot. You see this beyond politics. You see it in journalism, too. When there is a top editor who has a deputy editor, that top editor often says my deputy so-and-so, as opposed to the deputy. It's about the position. It's not about the personal relationship to you. And I think that's a sign of respect in politics. That's a case of Joe Biden signaling that his vice president isn't just subservient to him, that his vice president is the vice president and has a significant job in her own right. And so I think that distinction only will come out of someone who himself served in that subordinate role. And it probably grated on him every time Obama said, my vice president.
And that idea of referring to those around him, to the White House as my, constantly relating things back to his own personal story is something you touch on in your coverage of President Obama and how he referred to and refers about himself. Quote, Obama said to the Washington Post in January 2009, I'm the one who brings change. It is my vision. It is my agenda. End quote. And it was interesting seeing you put all of these statements of his and writings of his together into a single cohesive piece, because it lays bare something that I hadn't even really noticed as a passive observer during his presidency about how often he would, in a way, in almost comparison to Trump, like the Democratic Party was less important to his vision of political leadership than he himself was to it, which in the mouth of someone less artful, I guess, a speaker than him, does sound rather Trumpian, right? Like, the Republican Party is subservient to my wishes, my desires, my message. They are second banana to me. And I never really thought of Obama in that light, because he comes across in many ways so thoughtful, so reflective, to me often humble. But seeing all of that kind of laid out, I'm like, oh, whether intentional or not, he seems to have a bit of an ego on him.
I think anyone who aspires to the presidency has
that's probably true.
Has an outsized ego on those shoulders. What's interesting, I hadn't really thought of that during the Obama presidency. And then I think towards the end of, maybe in the second half of the second term, I read a book by Michael Eric Dyson, who's, I believe, still a professor at Georgetown. He wrote a book called The Black Presidency about Barack Obama. And he had one passing line about how Obama would substitute his own experience for the black experience in America. And I was struck by it, because the moment I saw it, I was like, wait a second. And I think I even wrote in the margins, like, he does this about everything. He does this about a lot of different things. I even wrote, like, fodder for essay, question mark, you know, like, you're always thinking of what will be interesting material.
Yeah.
But then once I used that prism, I realized that, oh, in all sorts of arenas, he uses sort of his own life story, his own presence as sort of a default reference point. And that's where that larger piece came from. Of course, looking back on it, it feels like a more benign version of a self-referential presidency than what we've gotten with Trump, where the my is not just my vice president, because frankly, the presidential nominee does pick the vice president, right? And it is a subservient position. Trump likes to say, my judges, my generals. Remember my Kevin, the former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
He puts all these different arenas in other branches of government that are independent of him, at least in an org chart sense. He slaps them with the my moniker to create a very subservient kind of relationship. And of course, generals and judges generally don't like to be perceived or described that way.
Yes. In your essay, The Examined Life of Barack Obama, you describe him as, quote, a man who seems always to be observing himself in action, always wondering if he is guiding the currents or is driven by them, end quote. And it seems to me that Obama, from your reading of him, he just strikes me as a man who is especially aware of readers and writers like Carlos Lozada.
I have no idea, but I'll take that.
To go to the JFK carried his bags example, he seems to be both aware of the power of that sort of narrative in building his own character for the public, but also in a very relatable human way, he is looking back at JFK and wants to see himself as him, right? Like in many ways, he seems like the most recursive politician I've probably ever seen. And I don't even necessarily mean that in a bad way. I think politics is inherently recursive because we are always trying to call back to a past that we're trying to evoke and figures we're trying to evoke in order to bolster ourselves. But in Obama's case, it seems perhaps because of his like inherent thoughtfulness, perhaps almost to a fault, he seemed to be thinking about that a lot, not just how others perceived him, but how he perceived himself in relation to others who he admired.
Yeah, it's interesting. So he's written three books, Dreams from My Father, which was the memoir that sort of no one paid attention to when it first came out in the 90s and then became a sensation when Obama became a sensation. Then The Audacity of Hope, which felt like a pretty straightforward, unremarkable campaign book, either when he was running for Senate or running for president sometime then. And then volume one of his presidential memoir. I believe it was originally intended just to be one volume overall to capture it all, but I guess he went really long, you know, because there's going to be a volume two. And of those three, I think Dreams from My Father is far and away the best book, just the most beautifully written. Biographers have found that he compressed characters and played fast and loose with some things, but it's just a wonderful read. He's sort of cursed by the quality of his first book because it's going to be hard for others to measure up. One of his biographers, David Garrow, who wrote a pretty tough biography of Obama, especially highlighted how he felt Obama was constantly curating his own life and his own image, ruthlessly focused on developing the kind of persona that could lead him to this great ambition that he said he had very early on to be something like the president of the United States. And I think you get some of that as you're reading his works and his speeches. He doesn't have to be so ruthless once he's looking back on the presidency, once he did his 8 years. And so his memoir of the presidency, A Promised Land, I feel like he's too much in his own head sometimes. There's some incredibly human moments that I remember. Again, often in these books, there's just one or two key things that will stay with me for a long time. And for me, with Obama, it's his first night in the White House. Imagine how disorienting that is. Like moving to a new house is disorienting, let alone moving into the White House. Obama, that first night, he didn't know what to do with himself. And so when everyone else is asleep, he just went around the house turning the lights off, which is like the most dad thing I've ever heard of. You know, like I do that. And that I loved because it just created the sense for me of like, this is a remarkable person, but also a regular person who has suddenly been thrust in this situation.
Yes, it reminded me of Annette Bening's reaction to being in the Oval Office in The American President from 1995.
I remember that, yes.
That kind of feeling of awe and what am I doing here?
And leaving through the wrong door, right.
Exactly, yes. One of the classes that I had forgotten in film school, but reading your essays made me remember, and I feel silly for having forgotten it, but it was a script analysis class, specifically how to analyze a script as a director. And it was to very carefully read all of a character's dialogue and look for bits about that character in phrases that might seem like nothing when you're reading it. But if you look at it through the lens of who the character wants to project themselves to be, that oftentimes a kind of statement that on its face says A might actually be trying to cover for a perceived flaw that is B. Looking at your analysis of someone like Obama made me think back to a phrase that he would use all the time. And it made me think back on it in a completely different light. And I want to just get your thoughts on it. It's almost a meme at this point. But the phrase he would almost always say at the start of a statement that he really wanted people to pay attention to was, "Let me be clear." And it's interesting that he used that, right? Because one of the critiques of Obama, I think, was that he was often so professorial and long-winded that his speeches, or at least his contemporaneous speeches, were the opposite of clear. Rather than declarative, it was like, okay, what is the point? It's a long and winding road to get to where you want us to go here with what you're saying. And so in that way, it's almost like thinking about the very statements that someone's trying to assert. And I think you can do this with any president or any public figure, right? Can oftentimes be the very thing that they're using to hide what they perceive as a weakness or a critique.
I'm remembering now a colleague of mine at the Washington Post at the time named Alec McGillis, I think early in the Obama presidency, wrote an essay about, let me be clear, being one of his default lines. And it was almost always a signal that what followed was anything but, was not going to be clear. You think it means that he's going to tell you like what he really thinks, right? Without any ambiguity or without equivocation. But I think it was sometimes used as a way to insulate the case he was making by making clear that, well, I don't expect it to achieve everything. So like the surge in Iraq is succeeding, but let me be clear, it's not the solution to all of Iraq's problems, that sort of thing. And sometimes it was the opposite. Sometimes it was like, let me be clear, I've been consistent on this issue from day one, right? But often it was almost like a safety valve. It was a way to explain that maybe you shouldn't put all your hopes into this one basket. This is not specific to Obama. I think a lot of politicians do this. It's a way to kind of shore up your perceived weaknesses. If you're perceived as being a policy lightweight or weak on defense, you emphasize the opposite. Let me be clear. When I'm president, I will spare no expense to protect our troops, right? If you're already someone who's considered to be that kind of person, you don't necessarily preface it with a let me be clear. Let me be clear implies that there's some lack of clarity around this subject. But yes, it was a favorite of his. But I like what you said about how we think about the specific words that people use, because there can be real ambiguity sometimes in what appears to be a very straightforward sentence. Did you watch any of the January 6th committee hearings that were aired on TV?
Some of it, yes.
Yeah, there was a moment where this young woman named Cassidy Hutchinson became sort of a star of the hearings because she used to work in the Trump White House and she was there on January 6th and was giving you play-by-play of what was happening around Trump when he gave that big speech. One of the things that was going on is that he was upset because the metal detectors, the magnetometers, were keeping people from going into the area where he was giving the speech. And Trump is about nothing if not big crowds, right? He wanted a bigger crowd. He wanted all the people to be in there. And so he was pissed off. And he said something like, let them in. They're not here to hurt me. And when I think about that sentence, that can mean two radically different things depending on where the emphasis was, which word. If Trump said, they're not here to hurt me, if the emphasis is on hurt, then it means they're here to support me. They're here to cheer me. They're here to praise me. If he said, they're not here to hurt me, it is a completely different sentence, right? It is a far more sinister sentence. They're not here to hurt me. They're here to hurt Vice President Pence or Nancy Pelosi or the Capitol Police or fill in the blank, right? Whoever, he didn't say any of those things, but they're not here to hurt me would imply they're here to hurt someone else. So when I read this in the January 6th report, I was desperate to find out how he said it. And the report itself is a little ambiguous because it cites that line twice. And in one, it italicizes me, the sinister implication. They're not here to hurt me. But elsewhere, in the other time that it cites it, there's no italics at all. It's more neutral. So I went back to the video of Cassidy Hutchinson describing this in her interviews with the committee. And she also presented it neutrally, maybe a slight emphasis on hurt. Yes. And so maybe it's the more benign interpretation. I don't know. I wasn't there. And even a report that has transcripts can't really tell you the real story. And that's frustrating, but it's also just so real. Because even when you have a running transcript of events, history and life can be ambiguous.
Comedian Bill Burr has a brilliant bit all about this. I'm paraphrasing here poorly, but he's like, if you take an event and you just read it back like a transcript, let's say a man and a woman are flirting and you read back what the woman said on their first date or whatever, and she says, no, no, stop, you're bad, stop. And if you're just reading it back like that, you're like, oh my God, this guy was a predator. He's like, but what if she was saying, no, stop it, you're bad, stop. It means an entirely different thing. It's just interesting how especially in our era of transcription and cursory Washington reads and just glancing through something, if you don't know how a phrase was said, and I guess explicitly, if you're going into reading this with an already bad impression of the person whose transcript you're reading, you are going to be predisposed to reading it uncharitably, which might actually obscure the truth that you are supposedly trying to seek.
That was the power of the Access Hollywood tape, that you didn't just have transcript of what Donald Trump said. You heard exactly how he said it. And that makes a huge difference. It's interesting. Obviously, this just happened, so it's not in the book. But if this book had come out 6 months later, I would have included an essay about the Hur report that just came out. That's the special counsel report on Joe Biden's treatment of classified documents. And what was fascinating is that that report got a lot of attention, not just because it didn't move forward on charging Joe Biden, but because Hur wrote something like, I didn't charge him in part because he would come across to a jury as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. But now a partial set of transcripts of those interviews with Joe Biden has been released. And it's murky, right? When you're reading the transcripts, do they really reflect a poor memory in some cases? Do they reflect a very sharp memory in others? But even with the transcript, it's still not entirely clear to me what some of those exchanges mean. In moments when he's trying to recall, say, the year that his son Beau died, and someone steps in and gives the year 2015. I don't know if Biden had a long pause to signal he couldn't remember. There's just like a dash in that moment in the transcript. Even having verbatim notes can be unsatisfying in that way and can be inconclusive in that way. I found that to be an utterly fascinating moment, trying to use a transcript to understand how a person's memory works.
And to a similar point, and this is true across the political aisle, this is not specific to Democrats or Republicans, but I'm blanking on the name. Hold on. I want to make sure I get this essay title right. Give me a moment.
By the way, I appreciate the extent of your reading. I'm so grateful.
It was a pleasure. It was How to Hate Hillary Clinton, Especially If You Already Do. It's just a perfect example of if you are predisposed to look at a political figure in the worst possible light at all times. You could have a photo of a politician giving a starving child a sandwich and be like, oh, they want the child to choke to death. It literally does not matter what they could be doing or how they're doing it. If from the get-go, you are insistent on interpreting whatever they're doing through the worst possible lens. The collection is filled with these kinds of examples. And it goes the other way too. If you are predisposed to like the person or they're on your team or you already think well of them, then they can make horrible mistakes or even do awful things. And you can find a justification for why they did it that makes them look better than they might actually look.
I think that's true. And I wish I could say that I'm just above it all. And so I see what everyone really means. And I distill that in my writing. I think I have the slight advantage of having a set of political beliefs that are really scattered and all over the map. My overwhelming political value is a skepticism. I don't believe anyone. And so I think that I try very hard to not walk into a reading of a memoir or of a report with a very clear predisposition. That's in part because in the end, I feel that people will be more interested in what I learn from an experience of reading, than what I walk into that experience with. That's what I try to do. In the case of the Hillary Clinton essay, that was my look at sort of several books. There was just this like Hillary Clinton hatred industrial complex. It was a remarkable, endless set of volumes about how terrible Hillary is. And this long predated her candidacy. This was decades in the making since she was first lady. And I think one of the moments is they're talking about Benghazi and the books contradict each other. One of them said that Clinton lied about Benghazi because really she was corrupt and lining up reconstruction contracts for her cronies in Libya and didn't want anyone to think that Libya was falling apart. So that's why she lied about Benghazi. But then another book says that, no, she really lied because she didn't want anyone to figure out that Al-Qaeda was still a threat. These are like completely different motives, but it doesn't matter. Like, why not both? You can always assume the worst. That to me was a really great example of that willingness to go into a story with such a clear predisposition that whatever you believe, even if they contradict each other, it can all be part of the story.
Trump is a carnival barker and a fascist. Joe Biden is both so senile and forgetful that he can't find the Oval Office. And also he is so conniving and intelligent that he's, you know,
lining his pockets through corrupt. Yes, yes. Yeah. Actually, he's a bumbling, doddering guy that's about to keel over, or he's this Machiavellian.
Yes, exactly.
You know, corrupt guru.
Pulling all the strings.
Yeah. But it's almost like just throwing everything at the wall, trying to see what will stick. And so it almost doesn't matter if you are purely a partisan warrior. All of these things, the answer is always yes.
I really, truly appreciate this about your writing, Carlos. You treat the reader with enough respect to presuppose our intelligence. I feel like a lot of political writing, it starts from a point of view that the reader is an idiot and that the author has to hold their hand so that they know how to think correctly. And I feel like this is true of a lot of things. I feel like this when I'm watching movies sometimes. I'm like, okay, so the director thinks I'm dumb. And so they have to spell out every theme. They can't leave anything to chance. They don't want me to interpret anything. They want to tell me exactly how to feel at all times. And I feel a lot of this with political writing, which has actually turned me off to almost the entire genre. And so it was deeply refreshing to read your work and be like, okay, he's not without his own opinions, but he makes it clear when he's giving his opinions. But he also treats me with enough respect to present me with the facts that he's found and let me feel however I want to feel. I feel like that is an increasingly rare thing in political writing. I feel like a lot of writing I come across these days, yeah, wants me to be like, this is bad. Here's why it's bad. If you don't feel it's bad, you're bad.
Yeah, I think the writer Matt Iglesias said this, that there's this almost built-in expectation that whatever you're writing about, you have to say, which is bad or which is good.
Yes.
Which I support, which I oppose at all moments. And frankly, I don't mean to be rude to my many, many outstanding colleagues who cover politics, but the barriers to entry to political coverage are not high. Some do it far better than others, that's for sure. But in the end, I'm far more interested in what journalists know and learn than in what they thought to begin with.
What close reading that you've done, either about a politician, a staffer, an institution, has most changed your view of them? Or of it, and why?
So this will be a little weird, but I think it's not necessarily my reading of one particular politician, but it's my reading of an institution. When the Supreme Court issued its ruling in the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, it had been leaked to Politico some weeks earlier. And it was obviously this sort of seismic event. And a lot of the commentary is about how the court had become hyper-politicized in recent years, and that's why you were seeing this. And I think I, not knowing better, I sort of bought into that. We've also had a lot of this excellent coverage by ProPublica and others about Clarence Thomas and conflicts of interest and all that sort of thing. And so that was my general impression. The court, this once enormously respected institution, is being interpreted and treated as just another political outfit in town. But then I decided to read several sort of landmark abortion decisions together over the last 50 years and see what they added up to. So when I say several, I just mean three, actually. I went back and read the original Roe v. Wade. Then I read Casey versus Planned Parenthood from 1992, I believe, and then Dobbs. Together, they were like a book. It was like 600 pages, three different chunks by three different sets of authors. And what I found there that really has stayed with me is how the politicizing of the court and the breakdown of the court's own sort of norms of civil discourse was evident in that arc. In Roe, you had even Justice Rehnquist, you know, he was not yet Chief Justice then, obviously, but he was an associate justice. And in his dissent, he showed enormous respect for the majority opinion. You know, like he appreciated their look at history and their legal scholarship. It was a respectful give and take. In Casey, that's starting to break down. You see the different justices questioning each other's scholarship and even their motives, mocking each other. And by the time you get to Dobbs, it's like they're on different planets, right? And they're flat out accusing each other of letting their politics get in the way of their jurisprudence and making really harsh accusations. And there they do, in fact, sound like any other politician. But to me, what was interesting was that this was a longer transformation than I had given it credit for. This was happening over the course of these 50 years. It's not just something that happened when they got this supermajority on the court. And so that is, I think, an example of something that changed my mind, not about a person, but about an institution.
If there were a quote from within your collection of 50 essays, from within the Washington book, that I felt as a reader defined the entire project, it would be a quote from the project of the 1619 Project, in which you write, quote, "These distinctions matter because, with this subject, framing is everything. History, Hannah Jones writes in the book, is not just about learning what happened. It is also just as important how we think about what happened," end quote. And throughout your collection, Carlos, whether it's biography or the 9/11 Commission or court rulings, what happened is just as, if not less, important than how we think and feel about what happened. How on base am I?
I love when I talk to people who have read this, because inevitably people surface things in new ways. And I hadn't thought of that moment in that essay as somehow summing up a lot of my own project. But I think you're right. I think it does, because there's the rush of coverage in the moment about whatever subject we're talking about. But over time, how we think about these moments, how we remember these moments, the meaning with which we imbue them, becomes everything. Talk about the narrative. They become part of this long, long arc. And what I tried to do in my prior book was to sort of capture how we were interpreting and thinking about the Trump era in a particular moment, like while we were in the middle of that Trump presidency. If you were to put those two books in conversation, the first book is kind of nested inside the second one. The second one takes a longer arc, and you see it in any number of issues. The longest essay in the book is about 9/11. And I looked at about 20 or 21 books over the course of 20 years since the attacks. And the way we think about the attacks today appear radically different from the way they felt in that initial moment. In the end, this is a long game, which is why I think you see so many of these books and why people are always competing to try to shape not just their own narratives, but the national narrative as well.
If we look at the arc of your adult life, or your career at the very least, you know, you were initially a consultant at the Inter-American Development Bank, then an analyst in the research department at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, now a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist writing for the New York Times. If a decade or two from now, if someone were to give your story a Lozada-esque read, what moment, what small detail of your life would they be able to hone in on and mine from it a larger truth?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question. But by definition, Michael, any answer that I give you will be the wrong one, because only someone else can find that thing that I don't think of, my tell. What is my giveaway phrase? What I think of as the big moment may not necessarily be what someone else thinks of as the big moment. But I think you put your finger on one moment that I do think of as a key moment in my own life. I never thought I would be a journalist or a writer of any kind. There's no one in my family really who's done much of that. They're a bunch of lawyers and like policy wonks and stuff and business people. Initially, I studied economics in college and in graduate school, and I wanted to maybe go back to Peru and work in the finance ministry or the central bank. And that's why I was working at those places, at the Inter-American Development Bank and at the Federal Reserve. That was the plan, right? But, you know, what do they say? If you want to make God laugh, explain your plans. And I just sort of realized in my mid-20s that that was not the right move for me, that that's not what I was meant to do. I felt like I wasn't putting anything unique of myself into that work, that you could have just put anyone else with similar background and they'd spit out the same reports. And I had this very sort of romantic vision of journalism, and I'd always enjoyed writing just as a hobby. And I thought, maybe I can try that. And if it doesn't work, I can always go back to like banking. So part of me jokes like, hey, you know what? It's been a few decades, but I can always go back to banking if this doesn't work out. You know, I got my midlife crisis out of the way early in my mid to late 20s, and that switch to journalism, which I think has given me such satisfaction professionally, was, I think, the key moment for me.
I think, as you said, we'll perhaps have to leave any additional insights to some future author a decade or two from now. We'll leave that to them. and I look forward to reading it. Your writing is refreshing, incisive, and perhaps most importantly of all in these times, fair. So thank you for leaving banking behind. Thank you for your time today. And thank you most of all for your work.
Thank you so much, Michael. Really appreciate it.